morning and a Freilich and Chanukah. Happy Chanukah to everybody. We are the first day of Chanukah, which is beautiful, although our Shira doesn't have any direct connection to Chanukah. We'll see, there's always a few little things that will tell you everything is always connected and everything is always Hashkacha Pratis, so I'm sure we'll find a few little connections for sure. But as we started last week, we said we started our new Chumash, which is the fourth Chumash in the Torah, the Chumash Bamidbar. Last week we did quite a bit of introduction about why the Torah was given dafke in a desert, the idea of a midbar, a desert. And as we said, this is not really about the giving of the Torah, this is more about the next stage when the Jewish people already have the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and we will discuss how they are. Next week we'll see more specifically about the different ways they actually camped around the Mishkan, and all the different significances of that. But today we're still going to continue with the first part, just a few of the commentaries. And as we see at the beginning, it talks about the Jewish people being in the desert, and the time exactly when they were, the second year, the second month. And as we said, that Hashem commands Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron and the Nesiim, the princes, to count the Jewish people. And we said the word for counting here was Se'u Es Reish Kol Adas B'nei Yisrael, which they translate here as take a census. And we'll see today more significances of the word Se'u. But the Jewish people will be counted. This is not the first time. This is actually the third or the fourth time that they've been counted, and then they're counted again afterwards. The whole Chumash, as we mentioned last week, is not only referred to as Chumash Bamidbar, that's the more famous one as we know it, but there's actually, it's called Chumash Pikudim, the Chumash of counting, right? The numbers, that's why in English it's actually called numbers. It's not referred to as desert, it's referred to as numbers because it has to do with the counting. And the significance of the counting we'll see a little bit more today again in some of the commentaries. Okay, I think that's all that we'll say before we go inside. I'm trying to remember if there was something else. Okay, anyways, hopefully we'll remember as we go inside the commentaries. Okay, so as we said last time, we gave a whole introduction from the Ramban. We won't repeat. This Chumash is not specific mitzvahs that we keep forever. It's more the time that the Jewish people spent in the desert. And just one more thing I do have to repeat is to put into context is the fact that when at this point, the Jewish people were really not supposed to be spending 40 years in the desert. That's what happened. And that's really what the Chumash becomes about. A lot of the stories that happened to the Jewish people while they were wandering in the desert for 40 years. But initially, they were supposed to enter the land of Israel very, very soon after this point. They had built the Mishkan, they had been forgiven for the sin of the golden calf, and now it was time for them to start making their way to the land of Israel. The reason I re-emphasize that is because that also puts into context the idea of the counting. Obviously, when we need to move and we need to take a whole nation and conquer a new country and then take it over and settle it, we have to have a census just generally, but also specifically for the army, as well as knowing how to camp, the idea being as they are going to be traveling towards the land of Israel, and all of the way and the formation by which they would camp was very, very significant in helping them keep their spiritual stature, keep the revelation, and also give them the strength and know exactly which tribe is connected to which tribe and how they were going to be going into the land of Israel. Now, as we said, that's not exactly what happened. They did keep their formation, but they ended up being stuck in the desert for many, many years. And that's what this Chumash is about, many of the stories that happened while they were in the desert. But just to see, as we say, a few more commentaries, we didn't do that much inside last time, about these psukim, about the concept of, first of all, that it mentions the word Bamidbar Sinai. It seems to be emphasizing, where are they? They are in the desert of Sinai. And we know that this is the beginning of the fourth Chumash, which means it immediately follows the third Chumash. At the end of the third Chumash, at the end of Chumash Vayikra, it says, Eile HaMitzvahs, these are the mitzvahs, and which the Jewish people are to do. And then immediately this parasha starts, Bamidbar Sinai, in the desert of Sinai. And we mentioned this at length last time, but just to see how the Baal Turim says, Leimar, im ein adam masim atzmai kemidbar, if a person doesn't make themselves like a desert, eina yachal leida Torah mitzvahs, it's not possible for him to know, to acquire, to internalize Torah and mitzvahs. And last week we went at length, so we won't go at length today. It is recorded why we have to be like a desert in order to learn Torah. Okay, then he says something interesting. He says, v'chal meiser bakar v'tzayin. That's also in last week, in the parsha, not last week, what I mean to say, the last parsha, which is Parshas Bechukaisa, the last parsha of Chumash Vayikra, which this follows, Chumash Bamidbar. So there it talks about the meiser, the tenth, the one-tenth that you take from the cattle, from the sheep. And right away, what do we say over here? Se'u es reish, that we should count the heads of the Jewish people. Very interesting. Al shum, al shem ma shenemar, oy taverna hatsoin al yidei meine. That the sheep goes, so to speak, how does it work? The sheep passes by the one who is counting them. What is this referring to? So this is fascinating. When you do the mitzvah of meiser, the one-tenth from the animals that we have, so it says, how did they do it? They used to line up the animals, and I think it was like in a pen or something, and then the animal would come out one by one, so you'd have a small gateway, and they would count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then when they said number 10, that animal was the 10th animal. And that was set aside, taken, separated, designated to be brought to the Mishkan, right? That was the Meiser, that was the 1/10. So you actually counted all the animals until you got to the 10th one. So you see here a concept of counting the animals, and you see a concept of designating one of them as holy. So the commentaries tell something fascinating. So here the Baal HaTurim is saying that this is similar to what we are doing here, because here Hashem is counting the Jewish people, as we mentioned last time, counting them. And we say a fascinating thing, that this is very significant, because just like what happens with the sheep, you count every single sheep, and then you designate one, and you make him holy. So Hashem is saying to the Jewish people, by me counting you, well, obviously through my messengers, through Moshe Rabbeinu, or through Aaron HaKohen, through the Nesiim, the princes of the tribes, what I am doing is, I am counting you, but even deeper than that, what I'm doing is, you are each one passing under, so to speak, my staff. I'm noticing and I'm identifying each one of you. And then I'm also designating you as holy. And what happens, very interesting, when something is designated as holy, we know what that means is that you cannot exchange that sheep. That sheep is the one that is specifically set aside for God. So Hashem says to the Jewish people that he makes as if all of us are designated for him, which means that we can never be exchanged. We always belong to God. So what does that mean? First of all, spiritually, but even physically, we have a certain sense of permanence, existence, of a permanent existence, where Hashem will not exchange us, God forbid, for another nation. So here Hashem exhibits his love for us, and thereby what we are meant to do is reciprocate and say, well, if you love us and you set us aside for you, well, then we will set ourselves aside for you as well. So it's this reciprocal relationship where we become literally Hashem's, and we become Hashem's in a permanent way. So that's the idea of the connection to the last Chumash. Just a very interesting thing that is fascinating, that all of the five Chumashim, fascinatingly, when they start, they actually express Hashem's love, each one in its own way for something else. But it says a very interesting thing, that Chumash Bereishis begins that Hashem created the world, but it actually is, as we know, the first Rashi shows us that Hashem started the whole Chumash with the concept of the creation of the world to tell us that the land of Israel belongs to whomever Hashem decides to give it to, right? Because he's the creator and he can decide which land belongs to who. And therefore he says that the land of Israel he has designated and given to the Jewish people forever. So the first Chumash begins with Hashem's expression of his love for the land of Israel. The second Chumash, Chumash Shemais, also is a Chumash which begins with the counting. We're counting the people as they have entered Egypt. That shows Hashem's love for us as a people, each person, individual Jew. The third Chumash, where we begin with the Vayikra, is the idea of Vayikra is to call in a beloved way. It's also love, and there we are showing Hashem's love for the Mishkan. The Mishkan, the idea being the service, which is the Torah and the mitzvahs, which we do for God. And the fourth Chumash, again, we are coming back Hashem's expression of love for the Jewish people. That's why he's counting us. And it says Chumash Devarim also shows Hashem's love. Interestingly, even though Chumash Devarim begins almost, it's quite a harsh beginning where Moshe Rabbeinu is now, you know, it's his last speech, and he's going through all the different experiences that the Jewish people had, and he's identifying many of the things that we did wrong while we were in the desert, you know, while all the way from the beginning, from when Hashem chose us as his nation. And yet, how does Moshe Rabbeinu highlight all the things we did wrong? He highlights them in a very indirect way. In other words, he only hints to them because, why? In order to save our embarrassment. Again, showing the love, that he cares so much for the dignity of the Jewish people that he will not openly and clearly start with all the negative things we've done. He rather hints to them in a discreet way. Again, love. So we see each of the Chumashim begin with an expression of Hashem's love, and as we see here, Hashem's love for the Jewish people. Let's see a little bit more over here. Some, like I said, some will do orally and some will do inside. So the Kli Yakar here points out, and again, just putting again things into quite a bit of context, as we said, that the Jewish people left Egypt and then afterwards they received the Torah, right? We know they received the Torah 49 days, we counted, and then we went, got to Har Sinai, and Hashem gave us the Torah. After that, the whole, whatever, it took a few months until we built the Mishkan, and now we are here in the second year. And it says an interesting thing. It says, if you look at the pasuk, it says, "Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe." Hashem spoke to Moshe, "Bimidbar Sinai, in the desert of Sinai, where, be'ohel mayed, in the tent of meeting," which means in the Mishkan. So here it seems that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to enter into the Mishkan and speak to Hashem sort of directly. Why? Fascinating, because this is a whole month after, so to speak, they finally set up the Mishkan. This is the second month, right? It says an interesting thing. I know maybe anybody who's moved or who bought a new house is aware. When do you put a mezuzah up on your new home? Not the first day, but you wait 30 days. Because it says that it takes 30 days until somebody's, so to speak, permanently moved into their new abode. And it becomes theirs. Like, that's like considered a permanent dwelling. Up until 30 days, it's only a temporary dwelling. So too over here, now the Mishkan is like a permanent dwelling for the Jewish people, for Moshe Rabbeinu, for Hashem's Shechina, more importantly. And therefore, this is what we are highlighting. Once Hashem is permanently dwelling amongst the Jewish people, now he's going to take the next step and he's going to count the Jewish people, which shows a very deep bond, a very deep connection. And now we come to also something interesting, because we mentioned, as we highlighted, and we'll see in a few different ways, the words that were used for the counting. So we say we are counting, and truth is, in Hebrew, the word that's usually, or actually in Lashon Kodesh, we might say in the biblical Hebrew, the word that's usually used for the counting is tifkoid, which actually means to appoint, but also to count. Pekoid is to count. And yet over here we have the word se'u esreish. Literally, the word se'u means to lift, to elevate. Why are we using this word? So the Sfarnu says an interesting thing. So first he says, why are we even counting them here? L'sadrein, in order to organize them, she'yichnesu la'aretz miyad, so that they should be able to enter the land of Israel immediately. Ish al diglay, each man by his banner. And that's, we said, we'll discuss next week more at length, the exact way that they camped and the way they traveled. It was so magnificent. Each one with a flag, but the flag symbolized so many different things. And the tribe were grouped very specifically together. So it says, originally, how were they supposed to enter the land of Israel? Ish al diglay, bilti milchama. Not with a war. They were supposed to be able to enter the land of Israel. Ela sheyifnu haknanim bipandeha. That as soon as they were coming close to the land, they would be such a glorious nation and such an impressive, and Hashem's Shechina would be so revealed on them that even before they would come near the land, the people would be petrified. And they would run. The Canaanim would have ran and deserted Eretz Yisrael. And we know, we find actually, K'maisha Asu K'tasam, some of them actually did do that. And we have a pasuk in Yeshayahu, which says, K'maisha Sheheid Ba'amre, like it actually testifies, it says in Yeshayahu, Ka'azuvas HaChayresh V'ha'amir Asher Azvu Mipnei B'nei Yisrael, describes that on that day, the fortified cities will be like abandoned of forests and woodlands, which they abandoned before the Jewish people. So when they heard about the Jewish people coming, that was enough to fill them with a fear, and they already left. And when they came, well, empty. But unfortunately, that's not how it played out in total. In other words, only a few people did that. It should have been entirely that way. But he says, Ulai, maybe, perhaps those who left, Hayu Mishpaches Meha Girgashi, from the nation of the Girgashi, Sha'alav Amruzal, Sha'amadu Panameilav, that they actually ran away themselves. But what changed? Ubikilkul Hamiraglim, unfortunately, as we know, on their way, they were supposed to enter the land of Israel quickly, but then they sinned with the spies. And because of that, Haysifu Hasheva Umais Lahara. So the seven nations which were in the land of Israel unfortunately intensified in their negativity. It's quite a fascinating thing. This shows that it's not only a matter of the fact that it took longer for the Jewish people and therefore the nations had more time to do more bad things. It's much deeper than that. When we do something negative, when we do anything which is not 100%, the ripple effect on the rest of the world is massive, because we're meant to actually be bringing incredible light into the world and elevate the world and make the world a more spiritual, a more holy, a more godly place. And when we don't do that, God forbid if we do the opposite, the effect is on everybody in the world. And that's what happened here, that these nations became even worse. And therefore, v'hutzrach l'achrimam, they needed to be destroyed. So in other words, they became so steeped in their evil that first of all, they didn't have the sensitivity to run or to leave when the Jewish people were coming, and they also needed to be destroyed. So that's what ended up happening. But what he's really explaining this Sfarnu is, why are we counting and why are we designating and why are we arranging the Jewish people in this way? Because they're just about to enter the land of Israel. And then he continues, b'mispar shemos, and this is a very beautiful thing which we will come back to at the end, but we'll just mention how he says it. How are they counting? We said last week, how are they counting the Jewish people? So there are two countings that happen in Chumash Bamidbar. There's this one, and then there's later on in Parshas Pinchas, that's actually the one more at the end of the 40 years before they really do enter the land of Israel. Here it actually says the word bimispar, which is the word number, but it also uses the word shemais, which is the word for counting, for names. They're counting them according to their names, which means we are literally identifying each and every person as an individual. It's quite tremendous. So what does this mean? Ki haya az kol echad me'ayse hadar nechshav bishmai. Each and every one of that generation was, so to speak, considered and counted by name. Hamayra al tsurasai ha'ishyes. When you call somebody by name, that reflects each one as an individual person. Lima alosam, because of their greatness, each individual stands out. Al derech ve'da'acha b'shei, like it says, I know you by name. V'loikein kara ledar ba'ay ha'aretz, but the truth is, when it came to the generation that actually entered the land of Israel, that wasn't done this way. In other words, they weren't identified each one by name. Uvechein lo nimnu b'mispar shemes. Why? V'lo niskaru zulase rasha ha-mishpachais. What was mentioned only was the heads of each family, u'mispar ha-ishim, and the numbers of the people. V'im ze ha-idea sh'haysa ha-kavana sh'haysa ma-ishim ba'atzmam yichyu v'yirashu ha-aretz. The truth is fascinating. It doesn't say really why here, but what we can see is there's a big discrepancy between the generation that left Egypt and the generation that actually enters the land of Israel. And we're going to leave it at that. We're going to come back to it later. But what we see is that the generation that leaves Egypt, that's counted here, that were supposed to go into the land of Israel but didn't end up going, they are identified, each individual, by name. But the ones that actually enter, the ones that experience the desert, the 40 years, but whatever, the younger ones that didn't do the sin of the miraglim, of the spies, and they will enter, they weren't identified by name, which actually signifies, you can see, they are a little bit of a lower level. But anyways, we'll come back to why later. We'll see a beautiful thing. Let's move on here. I want to show you something beautiful. We won't do this all inside, don't worry, but just a little bit to understand the Kliyakar. The Kliyakar tells us also that when are they counted? On the first day of the second month of the second year. And he discusses a little bit why, what was the purpose of this counting? What's the purpose of all this highlighting? And also, not only that, but he asks an interesting question. Why do we have to know the exact date? You know, the Torah is exact. Why is it important to know when exactly this counting is taking place? So the Kliyakar explains something beautiful. He says that he compares this whole experience that we're going through here is the Jewish people are marrying Hashem. What does this mean? So we know that we literally become, you know, Hashem's wife, so to speak. Hashem is our husband. We are the wife, which obviously shows the deep bond, the deep connection that we have as a Jewish people to Hashem. And it's fascinating that when a person gets married, especially like according to Torah, there is a few stages. There's the engagement, then there's the marriage, then there's the actual when you come to live together in the home. So he says here that the initial part was at Matan Torah. That's like the chuppah. You know, and that's like sort of, in a way, the chuppah or maybe even the engagement period. Then we come to when they build the Mishkan, and that's really much more of a marriage. That's like, you know, a real marriage. And then when you actually enter into the Mishkan, not just building it, but entering in, that's literally like when you're coming to live together in the same home. And that's a permanence, and it's also a very big depth, real connection in the relationship. And because it says, he brings a mashal analogy that there was a king who, I don't know, he found one woman and then she was not loyal, so he had to leave her. Then another woman and she wasn't loyal again, so he had to leave her. So when all these things happened, he didn't mark down the date. He didn't mark down when he married them. He didn't want to mention it very much. But when he finally found one woman who was loyal, who he loved, who was, he felt, the true right one, so then he marks down exactly the date of when he got married. And this is what we're saying over here, why it's highlighting specifically the date upon which we are doing this counting, because this counting is showing that Hashem is truly our husband, so to speak, and we are his wife. That's the idea. Okay? Then the Kliyakar continues, and he says, again, on these words, and these words are very, very significant, as we mentioned, se'u esreish, to lift, to count, but it also means to lift. So he says a very beautiful thing. So Kliyakar explains, what does this mean, se'u? So he says, it's like the language kisisa, or nasai, which all mean to lift. They don't mean to count. They mean to lift, to elevate. Ki mitzad ha-mispar, yinatleim v'yinaseim b'yeser se'es. He says, the counting is connected, because this is the word used for counting. But he says, by means of counting them, through counting them, what is he doing? He's actually removing them and lifting them in a very strong, powerful way, al kol ha'amim, above all of the other nations, asher ein lahem mispar prati, who don't have an individual number. What does this mean? K'may ha'kash hazeh she'ein derech balagorein litein lo'y minyan. Just like when you talk about somebody who has a farmer, he might have a whole room full of straw. He doesn't go counting his straw. What does he care of exact number of straw? As long as he knows generally that he has basically enough, he doesn't need to know the exact number of each piece of straw. Kach ein l'umais hashkocha pratis. He says, so too the nations of the world don't have a specific individual supervision. Ki im klolis, just a general. L'kiyum ha-min, just to sustain the species. Kishar behemis v'chayis, just like everything, animals, anything in the world. Aretz, aval kol ishbat, very unique is the Jewish people. We are mushkach b'protus, we have a very specific supervision. V'afilu echad mehem, choshev ka'uma shleima. Even one Jew is considered an entire nation. And that's why we say, v'nafal mimenu rav, even if one falls, it's as if many have fallen. V'afilu echad mehem sheyipol daima ki ravhu. Al kein nosan lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu misbar. That's why Hashem gives us a number like for the stars. As we know, ha-maitzi b'misbar tzvam, that Hashem takes out each star, each one of the constellations by number. L'kulam b'shem yikra, he calls them all by name. So he says the same thing over here, b'misbar shemais, to show shematzdike harabim k'kaychavim la'ilam va'ed v'chol echad yesh lo hashkacha pratis. Just like the stars, which live forever, so to speak, which are in a sense almost eternal, and they sparkle forever, so too every single Jew has a very specific supervision, a direct connection to Hashem, where Hashem literally knows every single, not only knows, he knows obviously, but he takes an interest, he cares, he involves himself in every aspect, every detail, the minutest detail of every single Jew's life. And this is very interesting, because a very important part of this is that it should help us. It's not obviously this is the way Hashem relates to us, but what this means is this is the way we relate back to Hashem, where we cannot say that our life is divided into different sections and say, well, right now, okay, now I'm being holy, now I'm Jewish, you know, now I'll go to shul, or now I'll do a mitzvah, and then the rest of the time is for me. We don't have that choice even. Hashem, so to speak, lifted us, which in a sense means that he designated and he made us unique, where our entire self belongs to him. So there's no divisiveness in our life. We are totally living a life which is permeated and which is full of our godly mission. And it's actually fascinating, because that's true in a beautiful way, and of course, which means that everything we do, even the simplest thing we do, we can make it holy, which is a beautiful thing. Which means even when we're just doing a normal walk, when we're doing a normal shop, a cooking, whatever it may be, interactions, every single thing we do, we have the ability to infuse with holiness, which is such a magnificent, purposeful way of living. But also, on the flip side, what it also means is it gives us a tremendous responsibility. And we see that as a Jewish people, that every single time a Jew does anything, the whole world is ready to pounce, right? But the truth is, it comes also from this, because we are different and we don't have a choice. So we can't shirk that responsibility, even if we would love to, but too bad. But it actually has an incredible, it's an incredible gift, because we have the ability to live our life, and we are living our life in a whole different plane. Okay, then the Kli Yakar continues, and he tells us, now we have a fascinating discussion. Because remember last week, we did mention it, but we didn't go into depth about this. We said, it says in the pasuk, Kol Zachar L'Gul Goloisam. How did they count the Jewish people? So we know the famous idea that you're not really meant to count people, right? We know that you don't count people according to number. Like, you don't, if you have 10 people in the room, you don't say 1, 2, 3, right? You, different ways you say a pasuk, whatever. And we know how they did it. Initially, they, after the sin of the golden calf, they gave the half a shekel, and then each half a shekel was counted, and that's how they knew how many Jews there were. But in this pasuk, it's a funny, interesting one, because in this counting over here, when they're counting the Jewish people here, just after the Mishkan is built, there's actually a discussion of how they counted. Was it done in a way where they gave a half shekel, or was it actually every person being counted as a person? Because look, it says every male, legul galaisa means according by head count. So Rashi says it doesn't, legul galaisa, even though it says head count, it still means a machasis shekel. No question that the people weren't counted, because you're not allowed to count people. That's Rashi's opinion. But other commentaries, and the Kli Yakar brings them, say no, that this counting was different. Why was it different? So he says like this, this counting wasn't done with a half a shekel. Why? So first we have to understand, he says, why do we need to count the people with a half a shekel to begin with? What's the whole idea? What's the concept of counting people with a half a shekel? Why can't we just count each individual by number? So the idea of fascinating things, we say like this, the idea of not counting people by number, he says, so he says an interesting thing. When you count something, and especially if something is valuable, right? So let's say if you're counting money, if you're counting jewels, something that's very, very valuable, and therefore by counting them, you're identifying each one, and you are giving it a permanence, and now you know exactly how many you have, that's actually, in a sense, a dangerous activity. I mean, even think about it with money. If somebody else gets to know, well, then you have to put security, right? You don't know if somebody might want to take the money if they find out that there's a lot there, right? So the concept, as he puts over here, of ayin hara, that somebody could look with an evil eye, somebody could be jealous. This comes with anything that you count, so to speak, and you identify. If a person owns a lot of precious things, whatever it may be, and they publicize it, that's what counting does. You publicize how much you have. You're actually putting yourself into a danger zone. And what can happen is there can be an ayin hara on that thing. So to avoid the ayin hara, what do we say? The best way to count people is by giving the machtzis shekel. So how does that help? First of all, you're not counting individuals. But even deeper, what you're doing is the machtzis shekel, as we know, is a form of tzedakah. So the tzedakah that you're giving, it's like a redemption of the soul. It's almost like it alleviates, it protects from the ayin hara. So the Kli Yakar says an interesting thing. When do you have to worry about an ayin hara? Even for an example, let's say. If you see by somebody very, very wealthy, let's say you're going into, you go into a store and a wealthy person pulls out a wallet and they count $100 out and they pay for something. You won't even look. You won't bat an eyelash. This is a very wealthy person. You know that they have a lot of money. $100 is not going to do anything. It's not going to make you look harder. It's not going to even make you jealous, in a sense. It's nothing for him. But what happens if you walk into somewhere and there's a very wealthy person and they take out a wallet full of bills? They count out $100,000, $1 million. And then people start to look, that's glaring in the eye. There's where you have to worry about ayin hara, because it's a very glaring something. It's a contrast. It's something like, wow. So he says an interesting thing. When the Jewish people were counted initially, when they left Egypt, there was a problem. Why? Because when they went into Egypt, there was only 70 souls. Very few of them were there. When they left Egypt, they left 600,000 men. There were 3 million Jewish people. From 70 to 3 million in a span of 210 years is incredible. And that's where we worry about an ayin hara. And after the sin of the golden calf, we also worry because we're vulnerable then. But over here, where we have just been counted a few months ago, and nothing has changed, as we said, so perhaps we are not concerned about an ayin hara. So who says you need to count with a machatzis shekel? And that's what the Kli Yakar explains. So it's a very powerful concept here that we're mentioning, this idea of an ayin hara. An ayin hara is there either when we're vulnerable or when something really stands out in a glaring way. So I said everything's such a shkacha pratis, because on Shabbos I mentioned that just very quickly because we don't have that much time, but this week is actually Chanukah, right? But coming up next week, it's going to be Rosh Chodesh. Shabbos is the first day of Rosh Chodesh, but Sunday is Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the month of Teves. The month of Teves, every single month of the months of the year, have a certain letter, a letter of the Aleph Beis, which is connected to it. And the month of Teves has the letter Ayin. Ayin means an eye. And the concept is that in the month of Teves, which Chanukah always is at least in a few days of the month of Teves, is the concept of us taking our eye, which sometimes we might look at somebody else with an evil eye, which means perhaps a jealousy, an intolerance, a negativity that we look at somebody else with. The month of Teves is the month where we are meant to transform, that our eye shouldn't be looking with negativity, rather with positive. Teves is from the word toiv, good. So we should take our eye and only look, so to speak, through a good lens. Where do we get that strength from? So the Chassidic masters explain beautifully that when you look at the Chanukah candles, when they're burning, and we're meant to sit by the Chanukah candles, you know, for a half an hour at least after we light them, and we're actually meant to look at them, and they sparkle. But what are they meant to do for us? They are very holy light. They're actually the light from the first day of creation. But they give us the ability to transform our eyes from looking at things in a negative way, from looking at things with darkness, to actually seeing the light, to seeing things in a positive way. And this is part of the work that we're meant to be doing over the next week and then the next month, the month of Teves. But it comes in over here that when the Jewish people were counted, so sometimes they needed to be counted with the shekel, so tzedakah helps, if you want to say, it takes away, alleviates the ayin hara. But what we really have to work on is not having any ayin hara at all. What that means is, for us, is not to look at others with an ayin hara. If we prevent ourselves, if we look at not only other people, but for sure other people, but also everything in life with an ayin toiva, with a good eye, and that means seeing the positivity and seeing things in a good eye, meaning that we want good for everybody. We want it to be good for everybody and for everything around us. What we do is we prevent any ayin hara on ourselves as well. Okay, but moving on over here, because really we're talking here about the Jewish people here in the desert. So let's see, we're going on over here. He says like this. Also, he mentions this concept of that they were being counted here, and the idea is, it says, they were counted from the age of 20. And this is a fascinating thing. Why specifically from the age of 20? So the main reason given is because that's the age of the army, from 20 to 60, and we're counting them for the army. That's really, as we said, because they're about to enter the land of Israel. So we need to have the army all set up. So here's an interesting thing, but the question is, why is it that you take people from the age of 20 to go to war? Why not from a little bit younger? I'm not much younger, but a little bit younger for sure. Still could be strong and able to fight. But we say a fascinating thing. There's a concept, you know, we think of bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah, right, 12 and 13, as the age of when we become responsible for what we do. And that is true. But midai raisa, strictly speaking, a person has, there's a certain responsibility that only happens from when the age of 20. That's really the age of maturity, really. And that's when a person is really held responsible for any negative thing that they do. So he says an interesting thing, that when a person reaches the age of 20 and they realize that in the Beis Din Shel Maila, in the heavenly court, they are now held responsible, they can be punished for anything negative that they do. So they start to reflect and they start to be more careful with what they're doing, because now they really have what to be concerned about. And what do we want for the Jewish army? The Jewish army is dependent upon not strength, physical strength, but spiritual strength. So we want people who are scrutinizing and looking and making sure that all of their actions are done properly. And that's from the age of 20. So that's why he says that's a very big thing of why specifically we count from the age of 20. And this also, the Ramban, it's just interesting because thought we would get to it last week, and it's funny, it's connected to last week's parsha, but it's all the parshas that we have now. He says also something very fascinating. I'll do orally. This is an interesting thing that he quotes from Rashi, which actually is not in our version. It was taken out, these words from Rashi, and you'll see in a minute why. He says, when we talk about all the people, you know, you count, they lift all the heads of the people who go out to war. So Rashi says, this is as one who says to an executioner, take that man's head. Se'u'es reish, take that man's head. It's a very strong language. To the executioner, take that man's head. What are we talking about? Are we telling the people that you're going to the army, you're going to be killed? Well, what are we talking? God forbid. And the truth is that because it sounds so negative and so harsh, it's almost like we're saying the 20 to 60, you guys are like being given over to the executioner. So Rashi, those words are not recorded in most Rashis, but the Ramban says we have to understand what he's talking about. So he says we have to take apart the word su'u. That word su'u that we used for counting is connected, actually, as I say, to last week's parsha. It says at the end of last week's parsha, Parshas Vayeshev, actually, when Yosef was interpreting the dreams of the butler, do you remember, and the baker. It's a fascinating thing. We know what happened. The butler, his dream was interpreted positively, and he was reinstated. He was able to go back to work for Parai and continue to be a butler. But the baker, unfortunately, he ended up being hung, right? So over there we have an interesting language. It says, Sue, look, it says like this. In both of them in their dreams had the same word, Yisa Parai, and not only that, but when Yosef interpreted, Yisa Parai Esrei Shecha, that Parai will lift your head, the Hashivcha Al Kanecha, and he will return you to your position. This was told to the butler. That means lifting of the head here is a positive thing. Your head will be lifted, meaning you are taken out of prison, out of the dungeon, and you will be reinstated to your original position. You won't be in the dungeon anymore. But when it comes to the baker, it's the same words. I'll show you. Let me see if I can find it. Let me see if he has it over here. By the baker it says, Yisa Parai Esrei Shecha. Parai will lift your head. And then he says, Mei Alecha, from you. Vitala Eischa Al Eitz. And he's going to hang you on the tree. So the word Yisa, to lift, is used by both. One is positive, you're going to be lifted out of the dungeon and reinstated. And the other one is negative, your head is going to be lifted and you're going to be hung. So it's an interesting thing, the Ramban says a fascinating thing. That over here, the message that is being given to the Jewish people is that Hashem is counting you. Hashem is identifying you. Hashem is lifting you. Hashem is designating you. But then it's up to you what you want to do with it. If you choose, your yisa, your lifting, so to speak, can be so positive. You can be part of the army. You can go and defend the Jewish people. You can help conquer the land of Israel. You can become one with Hashem. You can identify as a Jew and be elevated and lifted. Or you can choose the other way around. And it can be like you're going to the executioner, which means that you can be destroyed, you can be hung. It's up to you. It's your choice. It's a very powerful concept in life where we are given so much. Hashem gives us so much. He gives us, each and every one of us as individuals, our own abilities, our own talents, our own mission, our own circumstances. And it's up to us what we do with it. We have to constantly, it's not just at the age of 20 that we make this one choice. It's a constant every moment of the day. We have to decide, what are we going to do with the gift of life that Hashem is giving us at this moment? And it's actually interesting because what we're saying here is it's almost like it's extreme, our choices. Either we're choosing
to be elevated and lifted and so incredibly lifted in a high way, in such a deep way, or we choose and we can be literally hung. So every choice of every moment actually has incredible ramifications. Okay, then he says, what does it mean, tifkidu? That's the concept of pekida. So we said the word tifkidu is usually the word used for counting, but pekida also means zikaroin, to remember, the hashkacha, and to supervise, because, and as we have a pasuk, Hashem pakad asar, Hashem remembered tzara, the idea is that what Hashem is doing here is that He is guarding us, He's remembering us, He's supervising us, and that's the idea by which Hashem is telling us this is the strength that we have in order to enter the land of Israel. Okay, he mentions why over here we have Aaron counting. We did that last week. Okay, I just want to read you, this is a very, very beautiful, it's very simple, but very beautiful, based on a sikha, it's in Yiddish of the Rebbe, that just takes it a little bit more meaning, and then I hope we have time to do one or two more concepts about this counting, which is also very meaningful and significant. So he says, I hope you don't bear with me to read, this is a real Yiddish, so we'll... One of the concepts that actually run through both the Parshiyos Bamidbar and Nasai is their gemeinsamer inyan, is this, as he says, like a similar concept, wegen dem Mishkan in Midbar, about what is the idea, what's the main theme, the concept, as we mentioned, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, which was in the Midbar, in the desert, und wegen die Pflichten, welche seinen vertelt geworden in Zusammenhang mit den Bringen der Mishkan von Ort zu Ort. And the specific designated jobs that were given, that were divided together, so to speak, divided amongst the Jewish people, for them to be able to bring, to travel with the Mishkan from one place to another. And we didn't get to that, but here we're talking first about the counting, and then we talk about exactly how they camped. But then we also designate the jobs of the tribe of Levi, of who does what and how to actually move the Mishkan. Das unterstreicht, so this emphasizes, as afilu ven iden gefinnen sich in Amidbar. The idea is that even when we as a Jewish people find ourselves in a desert, haben sie dem Kayach aufzustellen am Mokim Kaddish. The first thing we have to know is, because the whole Chumash is called Bamidbar, as we said, desert, that even when we find ourselves in a desert, we should not feel overwhelmed, we shouldn't give up, we shouldn't feel so thirsty that we can't move. We should realize that we have the strength to actually set up a holy place, a Mishkan, for the Getlich Shechina, for the holy Shechina, to ruin Sevishin Eden, to rest amongst the Jewish people, Bechlal, on in Yedin Eden, Befrat, and specifically in each and every individual. So we shouldn't feel overwhelmed. We should realize that we, even in the desert, can build a Mishkan. So let's see what a desert is. Punkt wie es ist faran a Midbar in our körperlicher Sinn, just like we have a Midbar, a desert in a physical way. What is a midbar? A vistinish. A midbar is a vast, empty land. Wo es herrschen extreme klimatische elementen in allerlei mazikin. So he says, what's in a midbar? Very extreme climatic elements. It's an extreme place, as we mentioned last week. And all kinds of dangers are lurking in the desert. There's also a spiritual desert. So what's in a spiritual desert? The most harmful spiritual ideologies, all kinds of wrong ways of thinking, wrong perspectives, that's what dwells in a spiritual desert. Und das kann euch sein in a land, was in Gashmi ist, a bliendicker Garten. It's interesting that a spiritual desert can even be found in a land which physically is like the most blossoming garden. So physically we can be living in a magnificent place, but it can spiritually still be a desert. And then we can feel overwhelmed. So what does Torah tell us? Lernt uns die Torah HaKdoshe. So the Holy Torah teaches us. As gefinnen dich sich in a geistigen Midbar, when we find ourselves in a spiritual desert, Ken men, so we can, and very important next word, ubemele darfmen, and therefore we must, unmuzmen, so we must, eishtelen a mikdash, we have to set up a holy, designated holy place. Truginess, we have to carry it, ungain farais, and we have to literally go, so to speak, before it, we have to march before it, in the getlach eschinatrit, so to speak, so we let it lead us, and we go in the holy steps of the Shechina, bismen kum zu der gebenster heiliger land, until we actually arrive at the blessed holy land. To the emissar and fuller geula, to the true and full geula, al yidei Mashiach tzitkenu. And as we see, this is a very powerful lesson, because this is the theme, as we say, of Chumash Bamidbar, that wherever we find ourselves, and sometimes now we feel it more and more, in a vast, empty, but it's more than just empty, as we say, you know, with Yosef, you know, it was empty, but it had snakes. That's what a desert has, snakes and scorpions. It's a very, very dangerous place. And it's a place where we do feel thirsty, and we do feel in danger, and we do feel lost, and we can feel distant from Hashem. But we know we can, and therefore we have to, as we can see for the Jewish people, build a mishkan. We have to build, and this is up to us, that's the thing. It's not going to happen automatically. So we have to build a mishkan, we have to designate a holiness, and we have to walk in those footsteps and realize that we are constantly around the mishkan. The mishkan is at the center of our life. And I'll just read a few more lines. Das ist an Anweisung für alle, and this is a lesson for all Jews. Aber bazund für idische Frauen, and this is the Lubavitch Rebbe says, specifically it's a lesson for the Jewish woman. For es ist doch bewusst, as beim Bayin der Mishkan haben sich die Frauen abgerufen, die erste. Why is it specific to the woman? Because we know that actually at the building of the Mishkan, who volunteered first? It was the woman who volunteered first. Nach frier far die Männer, even before the men. In dem geistigen Midbar von gewisse Kreisen, was es herrscht bei sei, a wistenisch und a pustkeit, in Yiddishkeit bechlal. So he says this so to speak, spiritual desert of different kinds that many, you know, unfortunately, like you dwell in this emptiness, in this, and a pustkeit is a hard word to translate, but it's an emptiness, a desolateness, and you feel really, really very distant from Hashem. He says, and from Yiddishkeit, shein upgeret von chassidischen Seder Leben befrat, and especially from a chassidische way of life, haben freien dem greisen und ebig. So the women have the very tremendous and the eternal merit to sein zivishin die erste in aufstellen a mishkan la yisparech, to actually set up a mishkan for Hashem even in those places. And the Rebbe says there that women, especially with the younger children, but for everybody. Okay, we're going to leave that over there. I think we have yet another 5 minutes. Just let me share one more. There's so many beautiful things. I'm trying to remember which one was connected, any of them connected to Hanukkah. There was, no, I don't know, maybe we'll do this one next week. I'll just share one, so in orally, this is from the Nesiv HaShalom. So he says that, remember we mentioned at the beginning, the Sfarnu, that when we counted, remember we mentioned, and I said I would get to it at the end, so Tag, I want to mention, we counted the generation that entered the desert, they were counted by name, and yet the generation that actually entered the land weren't counted by name. So he says, as we said, according to the Sfarnu, this in a way shows that the first generation were in a sense holier. That's why each one is identified by name. Whereas the generation that enters the land of Israel, they are on a lesser holy status, and therefore they are only more identified by number, but not specifically by name. Only the families are called by name. So he says an interesting thing. That's why, and this helps us also understand a lot of the context of what happens in this Chumash. Because in Chumash Bamidbar, we have all the stories that happen to the Jewish people while they were traveling through the desert. And we know that unfortunately, and this is a very big question that we'll get to as we're coming to all the stories, they did many mistakes. Throughout, we find they keep on, it looks like they keep on rebelling against Hashem. Hashem does so much for them, and one after another, after another, after another, they keep on complaining and complaining, and another mistake, and another mistake. So he says that this helps us understand, because he says we have to put it in the proper perspective. The reason why the generation of the desert made, so to speak, so many mistakes, if you want to say, it's because they had a much bigger test than we could ever understand. What does that mean? Because they were on a higher level. When somebody is on a higher level, it says they have a greater yetzahara, a greater evil inclination, obviously because more is at stake. When more is at stake, the evil inclination works harder. And because of that, they were constantly feeling tested. And because they felt tested constantly, unfortunately, they did stumble. So we have to, as we mentioned, interesting with our eye and with our eye, refocus our lens, put a different lens and look at them differently. That it looks like, oh, how could they be complaining so much? How could they be making so many mistakes? We have to look a little bit deeper, but it was a much greater challenge for them. And that's why they're each identified by name, because they are so, so great. But unfortunately, the greatness comes with much greater responsibility. And for that, unfortunately, many times, they did succumb to the Yetzirah. So that's quite an interesting thing. I think next time we'll do the other part, but I think there was just one more nice part that I'll mention before we finish. Okay, so I'll let me stop the share so I can see you, but just one more nice thing, and then if there's any questions. Next week we'll also mention, I know we mentioned last time, a lot of depth about the desert, but it's actually, there's a medrash, a very famous medrash that says, not only in the desert, but the Torah was given in the desert, it's true as we mentioned, but also there's two more components, right? There's the component that the Torah was given through fire, through water, and through the desert. That medrash is actually mentioned on our pasuk of Bamidbar. So it says, through fire, through water, and through the desert. So just one very beautiful thing that the Shem Shmuel says, what's the idea of fire, water, and a desert? So he says that when it comes to fire, the idea is that we're meant to pursue Torah and mitzvahs with a passion, with an intensity of fire. But what we have, and like our hearts should be filled with fire. But we have to also be careful that when we look at ourselves and when we take stock every night before we go to sleep, we have to do it like water. What is water? Water is a much calmer kind of a thing, which means that symbolizes an interesting thing, that we have to have a certain calmness or a certain level-headedness to analyze where we're coming from and where we're going. So we shouldn't just be carried away and not, so to speak, do things properly. But then we also, he says, have to reject physical pursuits. As we mentioned last week, that's the idea of the desert. But also a very beautiful thing, that the concept of fire, because we talk about Hanukkah, as we know, is a very big emphasis on light, and specifically light that's lit as it's getting dark. And he says that fire, light, this is the idea that Torah is given with fire, that what happens is that fire is the idea where Torah is actually our guide. If a person wants to go through life properly, they must have Torah as a guide. And this is the idea of Hanukkah lights, as we say. We look at the lights of Hanukkah and we realize the Hanukkah lights actually symbolize Torah. You know, altogether, without the Shamish, altogether, if you count up, we light 36 candles throughout Hanukkah, and there are 36 Masechtas in the Gemara. The concept is that the Hanukkah light symbolized the light of Torah. That's what the Greeks didn't want us to have. They didn't want us to learn Torah in a godly way. We need the inspiration of Torah, the inspiration of the light, so to speak, to know how to live our life. Okay, well, we'll leave it over here, and like I said, next week we'll finish this concept, next week in Mirza Hashem, we will look at the concept of how they camped, very interesting, and the flags, very, very beautiful, different deep meanings of what they all symbolize and everything. Let me just allow you if you have any questions, and yes, okay. All right, I think you can ask, I think you can unmute, if I did it right.